Open the BCQ. Marcello, USA.
Alrighty, thank you, Gary, for introducing another hour of WBCQ 7415. And we're going to be getting into the hour of the time with William Cooper, but we just want to let you know that tonight's broadcast is a repeat. Due to the fact that there is much electrical, lightning and thunder and storm activity on top of Bill's Mountain, he's not able to do a live program tonight for fear of electrical outages and possible damage to his equipment, which being that he's on top of a mountain, and being that the electrical activity in Arizona can be very severe, we are going to be doing a repeat of the hour of the time. So remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is a repeat of Bill Cooper's hour of the time right here on WBCQ.
The hour of the time, I'm William Cooper. I want to thank all of you who call and sent email regarding last night's broadcast. I deeply appreciate your concern. Tonight you're going to hear the audio from a videotape called A Nation Adrift. And I think you might learn something from it. The last 30 minutes of the broadcast, you're going to hear the question and answer period that you were not able to hear at the end of the Dr. Relic tape that we ran last week. After his presentation, when that tape ended, he went on with questions and answers, and I was able to get an audio track of that question and answer session. So you're going to hear that at the last 30 minutes or so of this broadcast. So sit back, and you might want to take some notes. You're going to hear some really good stuff.
Almighty God, to obey his word, to be grateful for his word, which a humble prayer is protection of the faith. George Washington.
That this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians, not on religion, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. Patrick Henry.
It is the duty, as well as the proper interest of our Christian nation, to select and prefer Christians for our ruler. John Jay, Supreme Court Justice of the United States Supreme Court. The religion which has enabled civil liberty is the religion of Christ and his apostles. For this, we owe our free constitutions and government.
It is the duty of nations, as well as of men, to own independence upon the ever-living power of man, and recognize that the grand truth announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history, both nations are was blessing their endeavors because they acknowledged him and sought his aid in all their doings. They warned future generations that the day God was not earnest and revered in America, she would become a byword among nations. We would do well today to review their admonitions and the wisdom that was theirs when they fought the greatest and most prosperous nation in history. Not that we should simply look back, but that we should at least have a rudimentary grasp of God's sovereign hand behind the history of our nation, which our founding fathers so clearly understood. The result of this journey will hopefully give us a better understanding of where America is today, how she arrived here, and where she must turn at this critical hour. For as Thomas Jefferson once asked, can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have evolved the conviction that these liberties are the gift of men? Jerusalem, 1150. Saladin united the Islamic world under his leadership and began to chip away at the remaining Christian holdings. In 1187, he defeated the Crusaders at the decisive Battle of Hattin and eventually captured Jerusalem itself. Columbus stepped ashore in the Americas on October 12, 1492. The scale of his discovery was more extraordinary than even he could imagine. He was asked to alter the course of history as promised to him. Was that fateful day when Columbus planted a wooden cross in the sand of a small Caribbean island? But who was this man who discovered America? And what drove him to make that first epic voyage across the green span of darkness? During his first voyage across the Atlantic, Christopher Columbus kept a naval notebook in which he kept a precise account of the expedition.
December 26, 1492.
I'm off to God, but when I come back here from Castile, that I will find gold in such quantity that within 10 years the sovereigns will prepare for and undertake the reconquest of the Holy Land. Columbus had hoped to open trade routes to the Indies. He had a deep desire to evangelize the nations, and yes, he aspired to the titles and privileges that are certain to come with the discovery of the New World. But more than anything else, he desired to find a means to subsidize a new crusade to free the Holy Land from the grasp of the Muslim army. During the time between his third and fourth voyages, Columbus wrote a book entitled The Book of Prophecies. The vast majority of the manuscript deals with the restoration and the future glory of Jerusalem. It appears that he could think of little else. He was obsessed with the notion that the scriptures plainly taught that Christ's final mandate, the Great Commission, could not possibly be fulfilled as long as the menacing specter of the Turks remained in the Holy Land. He wrote,
for the execution of the journey to the end. I did not make use of intelligence, mathematics, or maps. It is simply the fulfillment of what Eisner had prophesied. At the time, I was motivated by the structures to go to discover the Andes. I have already petitioned your highnesses to see that all the profits of this enterprise should be spent on the conquest of Jerusalem. Clearly, the motivations of Columbus were significantly shaped by the eons-long conflict between Christendom and Islam. The evidence is inescapable. He sailed not to discover a new world, but to find a way to recover the old one. So, this last crusade set sail for Jerusalem, and somewhere along the way, he discovered the societies in America for nearly a century before there were any serious efforts to colonize the lands that today constitute the United States. The 16th century was the age of the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and in England, the spirit of the Reformation helped create a population of religious dissenters who rejected both the teachings of the Catholic Church and the newer orthodoxy of the Church of England. These dissenters sought to purify the spiritual corruption, and they were known, therefore, as Puritans. By the beginning of the 17th century, as persecution of religious nonconformists increased, many began looking outside Europe for a place of refuge. In 1607, the first permanent English settlement in America was at Jamestown, on the coast of what is now the state of Virginia. The second English settlement took root 13 years later, when a group of Puritan separatists established a small colony at Plymouth on the coast of Rhode Island, Massachusetts. 10 years later, in 1630, another group of Puritans established the Massachusetts Bay Colony in Boston. And within a decade, English settlement was spreading throughout New England. Jamestown, 1607. Captain John Smith is captured by the Indians. After days of captivity, the Indians decided to kill him. As they raised their clubs above him, a 10-year-old girl called Pocahontas rushed forward and laid her head upon Smith. The chief then spared his life. Jamestown, April 5th, 1614. Pocahontas, daughter of King Powhatan, was with the farmer John Rolfe. Powhatan refused to attend the ceremony, but intimated that he approved the union and would cease the attacks on Jamestown that had been going on since the settlement began. Pocahontas has been taking daily Bible lessons for some time now. Last April, at age 17, she was baptized in her new faith. Plymouth, England, September 16th, 1620. The Pilgrims had sailed for Virginia in the Mayflower. They were led by William Bradford and William Brewster. Here Cape Cod, November 21st, 1620. The Pilgrims drafted a document called the Mayflower Compact, and it is signed by all 41 household heads. It embodied the same principles of government, which would later become the cornerstone of American democracy. The compact states,
in the name of God,
Father,
having undertaken the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith.
January 21st, 1621. The Pilgrims gathered to give thanks to God for a safe passage. The Pilgrims worship from 8 to 12 on Sunday and again in the afternoon. Plymouth Colony, autumn 1621. The Pilgrims celebrate their survival at an autumn harvest feast in order to give thanks to God. Governor William Bradford decreed a Thanksgiving celebration in which the settlers would gather with the Indians who helped them get through their first year. The celebration may have gone on for as long as 9 days, and it was a feast of generous proportions. Boston, 1639. The Reverend John Harvard, a Presbyterian minister, gave half of his fortune for the establishment of Harvard College. The college was founded by Puritans, whose hope is that Harvard will succeed in training ministers for the gospel of Jesus Christ.
One of the original rules and precepts of Hagrid was, let every student be plainly instructed, and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life, and therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. Rhode Island, 1683. Rhode Island is now governed by its new charter, which begins, we submit our person, lives, and estates unto our Lord Jesus Christ, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and to all those perfect and most absolute laws of his given us in his holy word. Boston, 1700. Judge Samuel Sewall has written a three-page tract, The Selling of Joseph, the first outright appeal for the abolition of slavery to appear in America. His argument draws a strong parallel between the enforced servitude of the natives and the Old Testament story of Joseph, whose brothers sold him into slavery for 20 pieces of silver. New Haven, 1718. The trustees of the collegiate school have established Yale College because they were unhappy with the religious liberalism they think prevails at Harvard. Students rise at 6 a.m. and follow morning prayers with Bible reading. Williamsburg, Virginia, 1749. George Washington, who is only 16 years old, has been made surveyor for the new county of Culpeper. Philadelphia, 1752. After flying a kite in a thunderstorm and performing other experiments, Benjamin Franklin has concluded that lightning and electricity are identical. Philadelphia, 1753. The Liberty Bell has finally arrived from England. It was in good condition when it arrived, but with the very first stroke of the clapper, the mighty bell cracked. An inscription from Leviticus 25:10 says, proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. Ohio River Valley, July 13, 1755. Colonel George Washington, 23, and his British troops were ambushed by about 650 Indians, 100 French, and 100 Canadians. Of the 1,500 colonial and British troops, 977 have been killed. Washington had two horses shot from under him and had four bullet holes in his clothes, yet he came away unharmed. He said later that he believed he was under divine protection from Almighty God. The American Revolution was the most important event in the history of the United States. Not only did it transform the English colonies in America into a free, independent nation, it also did much to determine what kind of nation it would be. The Revolution was, therefore, more than simply a rebellion against English rule and the long, difficult war. It was a process of national self-definition. Noah Webster may have summed it up best in a letter he wrote to James Madison.
The Christian religion, in its purity, is the basis and the source of all human freedom and loving. I am persuaded that no civil government of a republican form can exist and be durable in which the principles of Christianity are not a controlling influence.
June, 1775. John Adams has formally presented a motion to Congress, and George Washington was unanimously chosen as commander-in-chief of the new Continental Army. In a public declaration, he stated,
I have proclaimed by every gentleman in this room that this day shall be the utmost sorrowful. I do not think myself overpowered. I'm honored with
July 3rd, 1775. General George Washington took command of the Continental Army today. The Southern general has described these Yankees as an exceedingly nasty and dirty people. His army of 17,000 men was more of a ragtag mob than a disciplined fighting force, and did not have sufficient training to perform a traditional pass-in-review for its new chief. No one, enlisted man or officer, seems to be able to give or take orders. To make matters worse, fewer than 12,000 of the general's men are healthy enough for active service. The army's severe shortage of gunpowder, rifles, clothing, and food only confirms what many local observers view as a hopeless military position.
as Washington told his friend Patrick Henry. When the day I enter upon the command of the American armies, I go back home and the ruin of my reputation.
On July 4th, 1775, the day after Washington formally took command, the following general order was issued. The general most earnestly requires and expects a due observance of those articles of war established for the government of the army, which prevent profane cursing, swearing, and drunkenness. And in like manner, requires and expects of all officers and soldiers not engaged in actual duty, exceptional attendance of divine services, implore the blessing of heaven upon the means used for our safety and defense.
Philadelphia, July 4th, 1776. 3 days of spirited debate came up today as the Continental Congress approved Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence from Great Britain. John Adams called the document the greatest ever debated and predicted that this date would forever be celebrated in America. Adams wrote, "It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty." Trenton, New Jersey, Christmas night, 1776. Defeat after defeat had brought the American army's morale to its lowest point. Washington knew he had to make a bold strike and go on the offensive, so he chose the pre-dawn hours of December 26th to cross the Delaware River and attack the Hessian garrison. As the troops prepared to get into their boats, a violent snow and hailstorm suddenly came up. This hardship, however, worked in their favor by inducing the enemy sentries to seek cover and reducing visibility to near zero. The Americans arrived so unexpectedly and with such surprise that about 1,000 Hessian prisoners were taken captive after only 45 minutes of battle. 1777. Because of the war, Bibles from England were cut off. Patrick Allison, chaplain of Congress, placed before the body a petition praying for immediate relief. A special congressional committee then ordered that 20,000 Bibles be imported from Holland, Scotland, or elsewhere into the different parts of the states of the Union.
Suppose a nation in some distant region should take the Bible for their own little book, and every member should regulate his conduct by the precepts there exhibited. What a utopia! What a paradise would this region be? John Adams.
Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, December 31st, 1777. Christmas dinner is little more than flour and scraps of meat. The men lie out damp ground in the open air, or in sheepskins and hats, to recompose the hunger and have a difference between waking and sleeping. If a British regiment suddenly appeared at the camp, these men might even be grateful to be taken prisoner. Half of the troops at Valley Forge are without blankets, and a third are without shoes, stockings, and breeches. Washington has written Congress a warning that unless there are new supplies of food and clothing, the army must starve, dissolve, or disperse. Washington later wrote, "No history now extant can furnish an instance of an army suffering such uncommon hardships as ours has done, and bearing them with the same patience and fortitude. Seamen without clothes cover their nakedness, without blankets to lie, without shoes, for the want of which their marches might be traced by the blood from their feet, and submitting without a murmur, as a proof of patience and endurance, which, in my opinion, can scarce be parallel." What could possibly have held this army together through this ordeal? How could an inexperienced American army stick together? This historian believed that the reason hopeless passed in Valley Forge can be attributed to their love of liberty and to their general George Washington and his amazing leadership. With any other leader, the army would have dissolved and vanished. His character and encouragement inspired the army to follow his example. From the beginning, he tirelessly traveled throughout the camp. His very presence was an inspiration to the men. It was Washington's character that helped sustain the army. But what sustained Washington? This question could easily be answered by Washington's troops or officers, for they knew this trust was completely carried on. On one account, the general's temporary landlord, Isaac Potts, noticed his horse near a secluded grove of trees. Hearing a voice, he approached quietly and saw the general on his knees for prayer. Not wanting to be discovered, he stood motionless until Washington had finished and returned to his headquarters. Potts then hurried and returned home to help his wife, Sarah.
If George Washington be not amused by it, I am quickly deceived. And still more shall I be deceived, if God does not through him work out a great salvation for a man.
March 10th, 1778. Lieutenant Wilson has been tried and found guilty for attempted sodomy with John Monhart, a soldier. General Washington has made it clear that homosexuality would not be tolerated in the military, as he stated.
His Excellency the Commander-in-Chief approves the sentence and with abhorrence and detestation for such infamous crimes orders Lieutenant Ensign to be drummed out of camp tomorrow morning by all the bombers and rifles in the world, never to return.
Yorktown, Virginia, October 1781. After a series of miraculous victories, the American Army finally had British General Cornwallis on the defensive. As a last resort, Cornwallis decided to retreat across the York River. In the official dispatch to his superior, Cornwallis later wrote,
"But at this critical moment, weather, from being moderate and calm, changed to a violent storm in wind and rain, and drove all of those, some of which had troops on board, down the river."
Due to this miraculous weather change, Cornwallis was unable to complete his intended retreat. He found his force divided, and Washington's troops began to move in on them at daybreak. Later that day, he surrendered his forces to General Washington. This essentially marked the end of the war. Francis Tucker in Lower Manhattan, December 4th, 1781. The senior officers of the Continental Army were assembled here for a farewell luncheon for General Washington. Ben Talmadge, a lieutenant colonel, was there and kept record of all the details. The general arrived, prompt as always, and from his face, he was as deeply moved as any of them.
With a heart full of gratitude, I now take leave of you. I most devoutly wish that your latter days be as prosperous and happy as your former ones have been glorious and honorable. I cannot come to each of you, but shall feel obliged if each of you will come and take me by the hand.
One by one, the officers shook hands and embraced their commander-in-chief, and silently parted. The tears streaming down their face, said it all. The simple thought that they were then about to part from the man who had conducted them through a long and bloody war, and under whose conduct the glory and independence of the country had been achieved, and that they would see his face no more in this world, seemed to be utterly insupportable. The dispute between the states was increasing and deepening. Each state was raising a lowering tariff, circulating its own money. Several states had sent their own ambassadors abroad to make trade agreements in competition with each other and with the United States government. In a word, the Union was a mess. George Washington, who passionately wanted no more of public life, now felt compelled to do all he could to save the Union. He started a letter writing campaign, the men who were in a position to vote safe opinions in America. Pleading from deep conviction, he declared that something must be done, or the fabric would fall apart. That something turned out to be the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in May 1787. It was originally convened to correct the flaws in the Articles of Confederation. While many were proposing amending the Articles, some men, such as James Madison, George Washington, and Noah Webster, felt a whole new Constitution must be drawn up. Upon his arrival in Philadelphia, Washington was the unanimous choice to chair what would become an awesome and momentous occasion. For the first time in history, men would have the opportunity to freely adopt a new constitution for their own government. the summer of 1787. Delegates came together to write the Constitution of the United States. 52 of the 55 framers were Orthodox members of one of the established Christian communions, approximately 29 islands, 16 to 18 counties, 2 Methodists, 2 Lutherans, 2 Roman Catholics, 1 Quaker, and 1 open deist, Dr. Franklin, who attended every kind of Christian worship, called for public prayer, and contributed to all denominations. Needless to say, an internal transformation of American society in the direction of a secularized egalitarian state was the furthest thing from the minds of these men.
Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other.
John Adams. Once the Constitution had been signed, many members of the convention continued to worry about the scope of the powers granted to the new federal government. James Winthrop of Massachusetts feared that the transfer of power from the states to the federal system would create a permanent aristocracy. And in Baltimore, Luther Martin predicted that the federal form of government would eventually become too expensive. Professor Alexander Tyler wrote, "The democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves a largesse from the treasury. From that moment on, the majority will always vote for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury. The result, the democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy." The ratification of the Constitution and the launching of the federal government in 1789 completed the first phase of the building of a new nation in America. A political system was now in place that would last for more than two centuries, with only modest changes. Americans in the first half of the 19th century developed a deep reverence for the memory of the Revolution, for the Constitution and its framers, and for what they considered the distinctive virtues and special destiny of their society. President John Quincy Adams may have summed it up best when he stated, "The highest glory of the American Revolution is this, it is connected in one indissoluble fact, the principles of civil government, the principle. New York, April 30, 1789. George Washington was inaugurated as the first president of the United States. In his inaugural address, he stated,
"It would be truly improper to omit from this first official act my fervent supplication to that almighty being who rules over the universe, who presides in the councils of the city, and whose providential aids can supply every human need. No people can be bound to acknowledge in the form of the council of hand, which conducts the affairs of the nation and all the people of the United States."
In office, Washington was a high model of nationalism who did not think of the presidency as a source of innovations in policy. He envisioned a government rather than a referee and expected American society to prosper on its own. Washington, D.C., 1802. President Thomas Jefferson, in his annual address to Congress, restated his mind to streamline the federal government. Government should shrink until its proper role, he said. A few plain duties to be performed by a few servants. Washington, D.C., 1805. In his second inaugural address, President Jefferson emphasized his past and present concern on the issue of taxes. In his speech, he proposed that Federalist Society's internal taxes be completely eliminated. July 4, 1826. The 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. On that day, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, both heroes of the Revolution, both former presidents, both beloved symbols of the nation's divine origin, died within a few hours of each other at their homes in Virginia and Massachusetts. To many Americans, the timing of their passing seemed to confirm that theirs was a nation especially graced by God. 1828. Next single American has contributed so much to American education, as has Noah Webster. He worked for 26 years on his An American Dictionary of the English Language. It was the first American dictionary and the grandfather of all others. In 1783, he wrote his famous Blueback Swallow, which did more for American education than any other single book except the Bible. It would sell over 100 million copies in a century. Noah Webster stated,
"Every civil government is based upon some religion or philosophy of life. Education in a nation will propagate the religion of that nation. In America, the foundational religion was Christianity. But it was sown in the hearts of Americans through the home, private, and public schools for centuries. Our liberty, growth, and prosperity was the result of a biblical philosophy of life. Our continued freedom and success is dependent upon our educating the youth of America in the principles of the Christian religion."
Rochester, New York, 1830. Charles Finney, who as a young lawyer once offered only scorn and ridicule to Christianity, has now become perhaps the greatest evangelist in the nation's history. It is estimated that the preaching of Finney resulted in the conversion of 1.5 million lives. He once stated, "The church must take the right ground in regard to politics. Politics are a part of religion in a country's case. And Christians must do their duty to the country as a part of their duty to God. And God will bless the nation according to the course Christians take in politics." Washington, D.C., 1843. John Quincy Adams becomes the first president to have his picture taken. He has been out of the White House for 14 years and is now devoting his congressional career to raising a consistent and forceful voice against slavery as a moral evil. Jeremiah Lanfear. He started a prayer meeting in the upper room of the consistory building of the Bethlehem Church in Manhattan. In a population of 1 million, only 6 people showed up. But the following week, there were 14, and then 23. They soon filled the Dutch Reformed Church, Methodist Church, and every public building in downtown New York. Newspapers were, of course, crazy, and reported to all of the meetings to see how many men were praying. In 1 hour, he could only get to 12 meetings, and he counted 6,100 men. Soon, 10,000 people a week were converted in New York City. Despite his own gloomy forecast, Abraham Lincoln was elected president of the United States. During the campaign, Southerners had warned that the Cotton Belt states would secede if Lincoln, that black Republican, were elected. Blow to those Southerners who hoped for a peaceful resolution of the nation's sectional conflict. A Northern Republican, Lincoln represented a party committed since its origins to preventing any expansion of slavery. As the Southern states began to secede from the Union late in 1860, many people in both regions assumed and hoped that the North would let them go in peace. Others believed secession was a temporary crisis. In April 1861, forces of the new Confederate States of America opened fire on Fort Sumter, which was the last military installation in the South still under the control of the United States government. People on both sides assumed that any armed conflict would be brief and limited. Instead, it became the bloodiest conflict in the nation's history. More than 600,000 Americans died in the Civil War, more than had died in all of the country's 20th century conflicts combined. Gettysburg. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, July 3rd, 1863. Today is the third day of the bloodiest battle of the war. General Robert E. Lee sent 14,000 men under General George Pickett against the Federal Center. Pickett formed a battle line a mile wide. It may have been the most spectacular sight in the history of warfare. Confederate Army began its advance. They had nearly a mile of open field to cross to get at the Federals, and the Bluecoats simply tore them to shreds. A few hundred men reached the Union line, but they were killed or captured. During the 3 days of battle, Southern casualties came to 20,000 men, and the North lost some 23,000 men.
The greatest contribution that people can make in this critical hour, a humbler earth that we take time to live. Let not be prayer at sunup, at noonup, sunrise, at midnight, all through the day. Let us all pray for our children, our youth, our aged, our pastors, our homes, and our churches. Let us pray for those who have never known Jesus Christ. Let prayer be our passion.
I've been driven many times upon my knees by the Alabama conviction that I have no more else to do. My own life effort, that of all about me, seemed insufficient for that day. Abraham Lincoln. Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, November 20th, 1863. Looking out over a battlefield still strewn with carcasses of horses shot more than 4 months ago, President Abraham Lincoln dedicated a cemetery for the nation's neglected dead. En route to Gettysburg, he confronted a man who had lost his son in battle there. Lincoln told him,
"When I think of the sacrifices of life yet to be offered, and the hearts and homes yet to be desolated before this dreadful war is over, my heart is like a lump within me, and I feel at times like hiding in deep dirt."
This deep personal grief animated Lincoln's remarks at Gettysburg.
Words can be little to stop the tragedy.
Nonetheless, the crowd of 15,000 on Cemetery Hill strained to hear some consolation.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Shortly before his death, an Illinois clergyman asked Lincoln, "Do you love Jesus?" Mr. Lincoln solemnly replied, "When I left Springfield, I asked the people to pray for me. I was not a Christian. When I buried my son, the severest trial of my life, I was not a Christian. But when I went to Gettysburg and saw the graves of thousands of our soldiers, I then again consecrated myself to Christ. Yes, I do love Jesus." Washington, D.C., April 14, 1865. President Lincoln was shot when he sat in a rocking chair next to his wife. The box at first view had followed up the purpose of the play, Our American Cousin. Wyoming Territory, September 6, 1870. Mrs. Louisa Slade became the first woman in the nation to cast a legal ballot, voting on the equal suffrage laws passed here last year. Nashville, Tennessee, 1878. Vanderbilt University House Professor Alexander Winchell for teaching scientific contradictions to the Bible. Of immigrants, a country inhabited by people whose ancestors all shared the painful experience of being uprooted from their native land to start a new life in a strange world. From this common experience, America has earned a reputation as a land of opportunity for the world's oppressed and a melting pot where a variety of ethnic, religious, and racial groups have mixed together to form a new culture. Civil War era would usher in the development of railroads and ocean liners, the rise of industry, a growth of cities, and the explosion of technical and scientific knowledge. 25 years after the death of Lincoln, America had become, in the quantity of her products, the first manufacturing nation in the world. What England had accomplished in 100 years, the United States had achieved in half their time. Cities were growing so rapidly that public services could not keep up with demand. Roads, sewers, transportation systems, housing, social services, government bureaucracies, public health systems, all were plunged into something approaching chaos as they strained to keep up with the changes around them. The growing sense that government, local, state, and ultimately national, had to play a larger role in the life of society than it had in the past. The belief in the ideal of the autonomous, self-reliant individual, an ideal that had been at the heart of America's image of itself since the founding of the Republic, has now complete with an increasingly interdependent society in which individual liberties have been balanced against public needs and desires. Washington, D.C., 1892. In Church of the Holy Trinity versus United States, the Supreme Court issued 87 precedents in coming to their decision, which states, our laws and institutions must necessarily be based upon and embody the teachings of the Redeemer of mankind. It is impossible that it should be otherwise. And in this sense, and to this extent, our civilization and our institutions are emphatically Christian. This is historically true. From the discovery of this continent to the present hour, we find everywhere a clear recognition of the same truth. These and many other matters add a volume of artificial declarations to the mass of organic utterances, but this is a Christian nation. And the screen's classic master of multitudinous magnitude, Cecil B. DeMille. The three feature mobiles in space, sky, and authentic backgrounds. Arizona was a natural choice. Not so natural was the choice of Louisville, Arizona. When the three tycoons detected the flagstaff, they found not only sun, sky, but also snow. Shaking the snow from their patent leather shoes and gray silk straps, they took the next train out. and ended up on a sandy strip of soil with the archaic and unlikely name of Hollywood. Because of a snowfall in the Arizona Highlands, a chunk of Southern California became the movie mecca of the world. Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, December 17, 1903. Orville and Wilbur Rust pulled their gasoline-powered flyer up Kill Devil Hill this morning. After winning a coin toss, the 32-year-old Orville climbed aboard. The 13-horsepower engine had came spectacularly and took off on a flight that lasted 12 seconds over a distance of 120 feet. New York City, 1904. A drastic cut in sea retreats has allowed Europeans to board a steamship with ten pounds in their pockets and arrive at Ellis Island less than a month later. If a decent job awaits them, they will earn the price of their passage in a week. Atlantic City, New Jersey, 1905. The ministers of this city reported that of a population of 50,000, they knew of only 50 adults who were unconverted. The revival of 1905 in the United States was linked to the famous Welsh revival of 1904, which swept like a tidal wave over Wales, where 100,000 people were converted in a 5-month period. The social impact of the Wales revival was astounding. Judges were presented with white gloves. They had no cases to try. No rapes, no robberies, no murders, no burglaries, no embezzlement. The district councils held emergency meetings to discuss what to do with the police now that they were unemployed. Washington, D.C., 1906. I can do one of two things, President Theodore Roosevelt has said. I can be President of the United States, or I can control Alice. I cannot possibly do both. Today, the greater burden was lifted. His eldest daughter, who has smoked cigarettes in public and once raced about an automobile in the company of three men, was with today at a splendid White House ceremony. 1914. Henry Hoover announced a revolutionary new method of producing automobiles called the assembly line. The secret was to keep everything in motion, Ford said. Our idea is that men should aid machines, whereas old production methods said machines should aid men. Ford is now producing a new car every 93 minutes. Known as Frank's Mountain. In
in her first newspaper, The Woman Revolution.
Birth control appeals to the advanced radical. The cause will be calculated to undermine the authority of the Christian churches. I look forward to seeing humanity free someday of the tyranny of Christianity, no less than capitalism.
She also published three articles on the necessity for social revolution and two defending political assassination. Margaret Thatcher was so militant that she was served with a subpoena indicting her on three counts for the publication of lewd and indecent material in violation of the federal Comstock laws. She then fled the country under an assumed name and a forged passport. In 1919, an article appeared in Margaret Sanger's magazine, The Birth Control Review. In it, she stated that her goal was to create a race of thoroughbreds by encouraging more children from the fit and less from the unfit. In her book, The Pivot of Civilization, she called for the elimination of human undergrowth, for the segregation of morons, misfits, and the maladjusted, and for the sterilization of genetically inferior races. In the years that followed, many other articles in her magazines would leave no doubt as to her racist views. The 1923 edition of her magazine spoke out on the restrictions of immigration on a racial basis. In 1933, the Review published an article on sterilization by Ernst Rudin, who was the first director of genetic sterilization and a founder of the Nazi Society for Racial Hygiene. Later that same year, she published an article by Leon Whitney entitled Selective Sterilization, which adamantly praised the Department of Third Reich's racial program. Margaret Sanger was also involved in what became known as the Negro Project, in which they stated that the masses of Negroes, particularly in the South, still breathe carelessly and disastrously, with the result that the increase among Negroes, even more than among whites, is for that portion of the population least intelligent and fit. The aim of the project was to hire three or four colored ministers to travel to various black enclaves and propagandize for birth control.
The most educated approach to the Negro is through a religious appeal. We do not want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. And the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea, if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members.
The project turned out to be quite successful. Scores of blacks across the country happily fell into step behind Margaret and the racists she had placed on her Negro Advisory Council. Roger Nash Baldwin has founded the Bureau of Conscientious Objectors for the purpose of helping draft dodgers develop practical strategies of resistance and to provide them with financial and legal support. On October 1, 1917, he renamed the organization, this time as the National Civil Liberties Bureau. Soon afterwards, the post office would declare his propaganda unlawful because of its radical and subversive views. Several people were invaded by the FBI to have a status confiscated. 12 days later, Roger was called to register for the draft. He resisted the draft and was promptly arrested and brought to trial. While in court, he professed his commitment to anarchism and his allegiance to socialist reform. He was then sentenced to a year in the penitentiary. After his release from prison, he set about trying to salvage what was left of his Civil Liberties Bureau. On January 20, 1940, Roger Baldwin moved to offices on West 13th Street in New York and shared them with the Communist Party's new Baptist tabloid. He also reincorporated to rename it for the third and final time as the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU. Some of the original members of the ACLU were Norman Thomas, who was six times the Socialist Party's candidate for president, William Foster, chairman of the Communist Party USA,
Max Eastman, editor of the Communist Party's paper, The Masses. Harry Howard, who according to the Congressional Record, maintained membership and affiliation with over 200 communist or communist front organizations. And Clarence Darrow, who dazzled the nation as a flamboyant and articulate defense attorney and anti-Christian crusader. During the first 60 years, a full 90% of the cases that the ACLU defended involved communists. As a result, the ACLU was stigmatized as a communist front organization itself.
Roger Baldwin stated, "I am for socialism, disarmament, and ultimately for abolishing the state itself as an instrument of violence and compulsion. I seek social ownership of property, the abolition of the property class, and sole control by those who produce wealth. Communism is all summed up into one single purpose, the abolition of dog under which we live."
Roger Baldwin would also join scores of front organizations, which years later, in 1976, he would admit were essentially recruiting centers for the Communist Party. New York City, 1917. A million and a half people came to hear evangelist Billy Sunday during a 10-week crusade here. Billy had been a major instrumental of the Chicago White Sox in their third season comics. He continued in profile for 4 years until resigning for full-time evangelism. Some 2 million, it is said, gave their hearts to God during the Sunday campaigns, which spanned a quarter of a century. Boston, 1918. The Boston Red Sox clinched the sixth and final game of the World Series with a 2-1 victory over the Chicago Cubs. But fans are still talking about the remarkable pitching of Babe Ruth. When Chicago scored in the fourth game, Ruth's record of 29 2/3 shutouts ended. He's also quite a hitter. Washington, D.C., 1919. Americans have always looked to the government primarily as a source of protection from foreign or domestic enemies, and not as the provider of services and benefits. However, many are now embracing a very centralized government the founding fathers urged them to fear and hold in check. Woodrow Wilson warned, "The history of liberty is a history of limitations of governmental power, not the increase of it. When we resist the terrible concentration of power, we are resisting the terrible death, because concentration of power is what always precedes the destruction of human liberty."
This is your alternative voice, WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA,
or B-A-R-O, Walter Burles,
W-A-L-T-E-R-B-O-R-O,
Walter Burles, South Carolina, 2-0.